It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll dive into the request to divert millions of gallons of water from Lake Michigan to the new Foxconn plant in Mount Pleasant. First, it's time for our weekly look at some of the biggest stories in national politics. President Trump is proposing that the U.S. military be deployed to guard the Mexican border. The first jail sentence has been handed down in the investigation into Russian campaign interference. And the head of the EPA is facing scrutiny over a series of alleged ethics violations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the National Guard should be used to defend the southern border of the country? Is it necessary? As Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation moves on, where do you see it all ending up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a correspondent for The Hill. He's author of the new book, Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out with the president's suggestion to deploy the military to guard the U.S. border with Mexico. He's been talking about this, the White House firming up some plans apparently today. Here's a listen to what he had to say yesterday at the White House.
We have very bad laws for our border. And we are going to be doing some things. I've been speaking with General Mattis. We're going to be doing things militarily. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. That's a big step. We really haven't done that before, or certainly not very much before.
And we're hearing in the news this afternoon, the president has asked border state governors to send National Guard troops to the border. What is the latest on that? What do we know about what is planned and what might actually happen, Reid?
So the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, just briefed the White House press corps on this plan to deploy National Guard troops. Important to note, by the way, there is a difference between, you know, sending military troops and sending National Guard troops. The National Guards are controlled by the states, not by the Pentagon, unless they're, you know, federalized in some kind of crisis or emergency. So he will need the cooperation of these border state governors. And three of the four border state governors are the governors of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona are Republicans, and they're likely to go along with him in some respects. The fourth governor is the governor of California, Jerry Brown, with whom the president has been feuding on Twitter for weeks, and they have a personal animosity that goes back quite a while. So I don't expect a lot of California National Guard troops to show up at the border. But this is, you know, in some respects, a new focus on an old issue for President Trump. The immigration is what kicked off his campaign. It's what resonated with a lot of his core supporters, people who wanted something done about the border, the influx of undocumented immigrants across the border. And this is sort of a return to form for somebody who has always seen this as a crucial connection between himself and his most core supporters.
This has been done before under George W. Bush, and President Obama had also sent National Guard troops to the southern border. Is there any sense that the White House is seeking something on a larger scale than past efforts?
Well, the Secretary of Homeland Security was asked about that just a few minutes ago and at the podium. You know, George W. Bush sent about 6,000 troops. Barack Obama sent about 1,200, I think it was, at various points of crisis over the last few years. The secretary didn't say, it didn't give any specific numbers or any specific timeline, just that this ask had been made. You know, this is a president, though, who likes to do things, you know, bigger and grander than his predecessors. So I can imagine that it will certainly be more than the 1,200 troops that President Obama sent. You know, whether or not it's more than the 6,000 that George W. Bush sent, we'll see. You know, the funny thing about all this, though, is this is a moment when undocumented immigration across the border is falling, is at the one of its lowest ebbs in recent years. The lower, not quite as low as during the depths of the recession when we were actually losing illegal immigrants over the course of several years when essentially they couldn't find jobs here in the U.S. But it's still pretty low. Border apprehensions are up, but the crossings themselves are down, which tells me there are a lot of immigrants from southern and Central American countries who just aren't interested in coming. So this crisis that the president talks about is a little bit manufactured, but it's a crisis that his base, especially the Fox News watching base, really loves to hear about.
And the president has talked about in the absence of funding for the border wall he's been looking for, this is the step he wants to take in the interim, it sounds like.
Right, and he's talked about having the military build the wall. That's simply not going to happen. That's not something that the Pentagon has any jurisdiction over or the president can direct with money that was allocated to the Defense Department rather than for building some kind of wall. So this is again, you know, some area of focus that he's able to speak to his core supporters at a time, you know, when he's coming off something of a loss on the border wall, when Congress passed the $1.3 trillion omnibus spending bill a couple of weeks ago now, that bill did not include a lot of money for the wall. We heard some of the president's core supporters, like, you know, Laura Ingraham and people like that, talk about how the president had been rolled. And there is one thing that Donald Trump hates more than anything else, and that's the notion that somebody got a leg up on him in the negotiation. But that's, in fact, what happened, and now he is trying whatever he can to not only put the focus on the border, but also score some kind of political victory that will inspire his troops.
Looking at some of the top stories of the week in national politics with Reed Wilson, correspondent for The Hill, talking about this idea of deploying National Guard troops to the Mexican border now. I want to hear from a couple of you right now at 800-642-1234. We'll start with Yordis in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think the biggest national security threat to the United States is Trump himself. What astonishes me the most about his presidency, among the many, many things that disturb me, is that he is profoundly lazy. This is he just shoots from the hip. He sounds to me often like a man that's drunk in a bar, just making up policy at, you know, 1 a.m. after he's completely loaded. And it's not based on a foundation of principle or ethics, or even advice of the great minds and experienced people in government. He throws out these things, and then everybody scrambles to try to fix or create policy around what he said. And this is chaotic, and it's very infantile. And I think it's making, as regards the border security with the military, he's trying to make an enemy out of one of our best friends.
Yordis, thanks for that call. I want to go right to another perspective on this with Kyle on the line in Dubuque. Kyle, hi.
Oh, thanks for letting me call in. Hey, I couldn't disagree with her more. I think Trump is the greatest. I think the military should be full on that border. I think California should be enforced. The more mad the liberals are, the more happy I am with Trump. I think he's doing an awesome job. And he is stirring up the base. And the rhetoric that he's talking, I do believe, has deterred people from coming in this country illegally. And if they think these people are so great, the very first thing they do is break our laws to come in our country illegally. It needs to stop. It should have stopped 40 years ago.
Kyle, thanks for the call. So two different perspectives there, Reed. First of all, our first caller saying it looks like this is chaotic policy, the president shooting from the hip, and then his staff scrambling to come up with a policy to back up the statements. What do you think about that?
Boy, you couldn't have picked two callers who had more different opinions, right? Mm-hmm. But therein lies the conundrum with this president. I mean, he is somebody who changes, sort of spurs our basest instincts on both sides. You know, there are some people who just absolutely love him and can't get enough of him, and others who are driven to distraction by anything he says. So we're in a pretty remarkable moment here in American politics where not only do we have these incredibly strong feelings about our leaders, positive and negative, but we also have incredibly strong feelings about ourselves and each other. You know, the number of people, of Americans, who see the members of the other party deeply unfavorably is up at about, you know, 60% of Democrats and 60% of Republicans. What that tells me is, you know, there are 6 in 10 D's and R's who think that the other side isn't just wrong, but also actually, like, bad for America. That's a really dangerous place for us to be, but that's where we are right now.
And then to some of the specific points they made, Kyle mentioning that the president's words, even before it becomes policy, his words may be deterring people from trying to cross the border. Do you think there's anything to that?
Yeah, I think that's a significant point. And I think there are a lot of people who have decided not to cross because of this crackdown on illegal immigration. You know, there are a couple of things that influence the decision to come across the border illegally or not. You know, one of them is economics. We saw that during the recession when the number of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. actually dropped significantly over the course of a few years. And another is the sort of rhetoric that the president has offered. Now, that can be a positive and a negative. Sure, it stops people from coming across the border, but does it also risk demonizing people who are actually here already? And that's a question that I don't think we're gonna know for a while, although it is certainly something that could harm Republicans at the ballot box.
Talking to Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're going to move on to some other issues. The latest in the Mueller probe, saying the president isn't the subject of criminal investigation right now, figuring out what that means. The first jail sentence for somebody involved in that investigation, and criticism of EPA Chief Scott Pruitt over possible ethics issues. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thought on those issues. That's 800-642-1234. More coming up here on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Reed, let's turn to the Mueller probe now. A couple stories there. The first, jail sentence. Alex Van Der Zwaan, kind of an obscure figure in this whole story. A month, it sounds like, in prison for him. What do we know about this case?
So this is, he's a Dutch lawyer who was an associate of Richard Gates and Paul Manafort, the two guys who were in the two senior Trump administration campaign officials who had been indicted earlier. He lied to FBI agents last fall about his contacts with Rick Gates. He was apparently worried that he'd be fired from his law firm, Skadden Arps. Along with a month in prison, he got a $20,000 fine, 2 months probation. You know, there's a sense among some people that he may have pleaded guilty and tried to get a sentence relatively quickly because apparently his wife is pregnant and he wants to be obviously out of prison once his kid is born. But this is, you know, a minor fish. But it sends a message to the rest of the people involved in who may have talked to Robert Mueller or any of his investigators, which is, if you lie to us, we will come after you. That's a very clear message to send with a conviction for somebody like this. So, you know, if they don't want to go to jail, don't lie to the special counsel.
And then the Washington Post reported yesterday that Robert Mueller told Trump's lawyers, President Trump's lawyers last month, that the president himself is a subject of the investigation, but not a criminal target. And I've seen people read this in all manner of different ways. Reed, what, if anything, do we know about what that means?
Yeah, boy, you watch MSNBC and Fox News, and that sentence means two entirely different things, right? What we know is that there is no defense attorney in the world who wants their client to be the subject of a probe. Then again, of course, they'd take subject over target any day of the week. But this is part of Robert Mueller's effort to get the president to sit down and answer questions under oath. Is Robert Mueller's hope. And then again, that may not actually matter. It's still a crime to lie to the FBI, even if you're not under oath. But this is a part of his effort to get the president to sit down for an interview. So while he may not be a target right now, he is certainly a subject of the probe. And, you know, that can't make anybody who knows anything about the law feel any good about where Robert Mueller's going. I think it's pretty clear, though, that, you know, the lawyers for the president who told him that this thing would be wrapped up, you know, by last Thanksgiving or by the end of the year or within another couple of months, that's not the case. And this is an investigation that's going to drag out for quite a long time. It looks like Robert Mueller has, you know, tentacles going into several different directions and maybe even into the president's finances itself. So this thing is not going away anytime soon. And by the way, there was an important caveat to that, the fact that the president is not the target but his subject. He's not a target yet. That's the important thing that I think a lot of people are worried about on the president's legal team.
Another legal concern at the White House, scrutiny on Scott Pruitt, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, for possible ethics violations. Can you round up a few of the things that the concerns that people are raising there?
Right. So we remember that Scott Pruitt, who was the Attorney General of Oklahoma, before he became the EPA administrator, got in trouble a couple of months ago for all these first-class flights he was taking. His people said that it was for security. Some people cast doubt on that. Apparently, he also took his security detail with him on a trip. Apparently, he likes them a lot. However, the latest that's gotten him in some hot water is the fact that he has he's done two things, really. First of all, he lived in a townhouse or an apartment up on Capitol Hill just a couple of blocks away from the Capitol building. I walk by it every now and then. It's a beautiful building. And he was paying about $50 of rent per night while he was there, and only on the nights when he was actually there, sort of like an exclusive Airbnb, if you will, that the taxpayers were footing the bill for, or the taxpayers weren't footing the bill. He was having to pay for it. But, hey, only $50 a night in prime location up on Capitol Hill, that looks like a series of favors that he's been done by the people who own this building, who, by the way, happen to be lobbyists here in D.C., one of whom at least used to, it's not clear if he does anymore, lobby on behalf of clients who had business before the EPA. So that looks a little sketchy. The other part is he went around the White House to give two of his aides significant raises under a small and sort of obscure provision within the EPA. And by the way, these aides were folks who came with him from Oklahoma, and they are now making significantly more than their predecessors in either the Obama administration or the Bush administration made. He gave those raises even after the White House declined to sign off on them. The White House usually has to sign off on raises given to political appointees. And so now Scott Pruitt's in the hot seat. You know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, was just asked to defend him, and she said effectively, "We're still looking into it," which is not exactly a vote of confidence that any administration official wants to hear. The good news is that President Trump and Chief of Staff John Kelly called Pruitt to offer their sort of reassurance in the last few days. The bad news is that tends to be what happens right before somebody gets fired in the Trump administration.
Right. The president was asked about this in sort of a free ranging back and forth with the press. And he said something like, "I hope he does great," was his statement about Scott Pruitt.
Yep. And that, by the way, let's also say the Pruitt has this very convenient off-ramp if he wants it. But the time is ticking. There is an open race for governor in Oklahoma, back where Pruitt is from. The filing deadline is next Friday, April 13th. So if he quits before April 13th, he can credibly say, I'm quitting now to run for governor of Oklahoma, rather than I'm quitting because I got a sweetheart deal from a bunch of lobbyists after taking a bunch of first-class flights and giving my friends big raises.
Talking to Reed Wilson, correspondent for The Hill, about some of the top news in national politics. President Trump criticizing the company Amazon this week, tweeting a lot about the effect he says the company's having on the U.S. Postal Service. Here's a bit of what he had to say yesterday.
The post office is losing billions of dollars, and the taxpayers are paying for that money because it delivers packages for Amazon at a very below cost. And that's not fair to the United States. It's not fair to our taxpayers. And Amazon has the money to pay the fair rate at the post office, which would be much more than they're paying right now.
We've seen fact-checking on this. What are people saying about this claim of a post office rip-off here?
There are so many things wrong with that clip that you just played. We'd be here for the rest of the afternoon if I went through all of it. The fact is, the post office is losing billions of dollars. However, that is a decades-long problem that involves pension costs and the fact that we use this crazy newfangled thing called email instead of sending each other letters these days. Amazon is so good for the USPS's business that there are now areas, including my hometown here in D.C., where the post office effectively runs on Sunday running deliveries for Amazon because it makes them more money. So, in fact, the post office is doing badly. It's doing less badly because Amazon is around. This is a remarkable moment by a president. I can't recall another American president attacking an American business so audibly. Of course, Jeff Bezos, the guy who owns, or the CEO of Amazon, owns the Washington Post, which has been reporting quite critically on President Trump for the last, since he got into electoral politics. Bezos, by the way, I'd also say, Bezos is the richest man in the world, and President Trump really hates it when anybody's richer than he is.
Want to touch on a couple of stories quickly, Reed. First of all, as I look at national news, I keep seeing Wisconsin in it with our Supreme Court race. Are people in D.C. watching what just happened here?
I was up late last night watching the results come in. And, you know, the thing that always strikes me, first of all, $4.5 million for a state Supreme Court race, and that was, by the way, just the money spent on television, is a remarkable amount of money spent by both the liberal and the conservative outside groups. You know, we've seen that kind of spending ramp up, especially over the last decade in Wisconsin. I got to imagine you guys are pretty tired of watching all these political ads on TV.
It's a big boost to our state economy, is all I know. And then I want to turn to a state story, not a Wisconsin state story, that you wrote about. Reed, thought this one was interesting. Rhode Island, the state or commonwealth? Is that a commonwealth? I don't know. Rhode Island, they are offering, or there's a proposal, I should say, to offer money to people to move there for a year. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is my favorite part of writing on the state beat, is all these sort of crazy proposals that come up. You know, every 10 years, the U.S. conducts the census, and based on those population numbers, we reapportion the number of congressional seats around the country. Well, Rhode Island's population has been growing so slowly that they're now at risk of losing their second seat in the U.S. House of Representatives for the first time since 1789. They are right on the threshold, you know, based on just how the next few years go in terms of who moves there, they could lose the seat or they could just barely save it. So there is a state representative in Rhode Island who has proposed giving families of three or more up to $10,000 in monthly chunks, monthly installments, to move to Rhode Island so that they could be counted during the census. Now, let me be very clear, this is never going to happen. But I thought it was a pretty creative way to try to stave off what is inevitably going to be a state losing a congressional seat.
So people will be watching for a sign from Providence to see if they should move to Rhode Island. Reed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, you're pretty good at that wordplay. I like it. Thanks, Rob.
That's what they pay me for. Well, they actually try to make me not do it. That was Reed Wilson, correspondent for The Hill and author of the new book, Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Should talk to him about that sometime. But he was with us today for our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. Foxconn is looking to divert 7 million gallons of water a day from Lake Michigan. That water would be used to make LCD screens at the company's site in Mount Pleasant, due to start construction in just a couple months. Some members of the public and environmentalists are raising questions about the legality of that move, pointing to the Great Lakes Compact, an international agreement between the 8 Great Lakes states in the U.S. and Canadian provinces that border the lakes. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. He recently took a closer look at the compact and state laws that govern water usage with the Great Lakes. Talked to him earlier today. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we had this big Waukesha water story, and now we've got this Foxconn plant, and they want to withdraw water. We'll get into why in just a bit. They're comparable amounts of water, but it's a very different path to get the approval, right?
That's correct. And it's basically because of where they fall in relation to the boundary of the Great Lakes Basin. Waukesha was outside of it, but in a county that straddles the basin, whereas the site of the Foxconn plant straddles the basin line itself. And under the terms of the Great Lakes Compact, which is this 8-state agreement that President George W. Bush signed in 2008, those two situations create different conditions under which you have to, you know, make an effort to get the water.
Right. So it sounds like a fine distinction. You're in a straddling county, or you're on a straddling site of the Great Lakes Basin. By this Great Lakes Compact, and thus by state law too, right, a whole different set of laws apply.
That's right. And the way the compact works is it was ratified by all 8 Great Lakes states. So to some extent, it's kind of encoded in our state laws as well as being this agreement in the region. And really, a lot of the enforcement of it is down to the individual states and their environmental regulators.
And with Waukesha, that wasn't the case, though, because it was in the straddling county. All the other states, and I think the Canadian provinces, right, they had to sign off on Waukesha withdrawing water because they were in that straddling county, not straddling the basin itself.
Right. So the governors of the 8 states had to give them unanimous approval for that, and it was considered this big test of the compact and precedent setting because, again, it's a relatively young body of law. So you know, it was one of the first real chances that people had to kind of try to flesh out what does this mean in certain circumstances.
Now let's dig more into Foxconn. First of all, talk about the water needs of this, I keep saying proposed facility. It's more or less a done deal, except the ground hasn't been broken yet. But talk about what they need water for.
Right. So Foxconn is planning to buy its water from the city of Racine's water utility. Of course, Racine is right there on the lake, and they have the right to take quite a bit of Great Lakes water. And Racine is asking on their behalf to take 7 million gallons of water and send it over to this site that is partially outside of the Great Lakes Basin. And essentially, under the compact, this doesn't trigger any particular need for regional review at this point just yet. And it's something that's largely up to the state and its own kind of internal environmental permitting processes, which obviously state and federal laws apply to that.
And you said 7 million gallons, that's per day.
Per day.
Per day. And part of the story here, as I understand it, is, you know, some of that water is going to be used, treated, and go back into Lake Michigan. Some of it isn't. And that, under the Great Lakes Compact, is an important distinction.
Right. So there's using water and consuming water, or what's called consumptive use, where you take water and it gets, you know, evaporated or incorporated into a product somehow, you know, that could be shipped outside of the basin, you know, or just otherwise can't be treated and then returned to the watershed that you took it out of. In electronics manufacturing, you use a lot of water because you have all of these components that have to stay clean as you're fabricating them and putting them together. So they're, you know, rinsed and rinsed and rinsed over and over again. And of course, there's going to be all kinds of other things there that use water, from, you know, toilets to cooling towers. Yeah, it's going to need a copious amount of water, and they're saying that they expect to have a consumptive use of about 39%, and I'm still trying in my reporting to figure out if that's, you know, an out-of-the-ordinary amount of consumptive use for an industrial facility. I've got some indications that it is, but I'm still kind of digging into that.
If they hit a certain amount, I think it was 5 million gallons of consumptive use a day,
new consumptive use a day.
If they hit that, that would trigger a review now by the other states, but a non-binding view. So they could look at it, weigh in on it, but not thwart it. They couldn't stop it.
Right. And the interesting thing is that if you look at the compact, there's obviously a general spirit in there that people are supposed to use water efficiently and conserve it and return water into the basin and, you know, not just deplete this tremendous freshwater resource that we have in the region. But there aren't a lot of, you know, hard number figures limiting how much consumptive use you can really have.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about a request for water use by the Racine utility for the company Foxconn. And so with this procedure as it is, what approval does Racine need? Who signs off on it?
Basically, they need a permit from the state, from the Department of Natural Resources. You know, just about anyone, you know, discharging wastewater in the state has to have a permit under state environmental regulations. And, you know, under the compact, the state has, you know, authority to approve this diversion, you know, according to its own laws and according to the broader terms of the compact.
Some people have objected to this, saying, OK, Waukesha is one thing. It's for people's drinking water, among other things. Some people have objected, saying this is a special withdrawal of water from the lake for one manufacturing facility, for one private business. Does that matter legally?
That's what people are trying to find out. And, you know, people objecting to this, they actually have a really good point, because the 7 million gallons that they're asking to kind of be able to send outside the basin in whole or in part, if you look at Racine's application to the state, they're basically saying that all of that is for industrial or commercial use. But they're kind of making this argument that it fits into the broader condition of being for a public water utility's use, because in the aggregate, Racine still mostly serves residential customers. That's by number of customers and by kind of sheer water volume. And so this could possibly trigger some really hairy conversations about what some of the specific language in the compact really means. You know, when these conditions that are placed on diversions, do they just kind of apply to the area outside the basin where someone wants to send water? Does it apply in the aggregate to the entire area of service? And there's a term in there called public water supply purposes that says that it's supposed to be largely residential customers, but there's no hard number on what largely is. It's also, you know, completely common for public water utilities to sell water to industrial users. In Racine right now, there's about 40 such users. So, I mean, that's part of the general thing of what a public water utility is and does. But, you know, the interesting thing here is that what they kind of want to do for this diversion is, at least for the time being, entirely for industrial and commercial use.
And hypothetically, Foxconn could get this permit approved now. Things are going gangbusters in a few years. They want to expand operations. They could request via Racine Utility more water. Is that right?
Right. And as I understand it, the amounts that they request would kind of count up cumulatively toward that 5 million gallons of consumptive use threshold. So, you know, it appears they couldn't just kind of come back later and incrementally work their way up way past that without triggering the requirement.
Is there expected to be a strong legal challenge to this request, or is it expected to be smooth sailing? Do we have a sense of what the response to the to Racine's request is going to be?
Well, the DNR has heard, I think, about 800 public comments, they've told me. And, of course, there's been a lot of concern, a lot of opposition from the public and from environmental advocacy groups. And a lot of it does revolve around just the fact that this diversion is, you know, almost entirely at the behest of this one private for-profit company.
Is there any kind of timeline on when we're going to know about this?
The DNR's goal is to have some kind of decision by about early May. But that's a goal, and they're not 100% sure if they're going to meet it, just because it's a complex process, and they now have all these public comments that they have to go over and try to respond to.
I keep seeing the phrase groundbreaking for the plant in about 2 months from now, so they would probably want that water approval in hand before they break out the shovels.
Right, and I mean, given the political situation in the state and the way that DNR has kind of been treated by the legislature and the governor, it's kind of hard to imagine DNR not giving Foxconn what it wants at this point, you know, especially given the fact that this incentives package the legislature passed for Foxconn, you know, had, you know, these environmental exemptions, you know, included in it. So there's definitely political pressure to really fast track this and not stand in their way on, you know, on environmental grounds or any other grounds.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. He was with us to talk about the request for Lake Michigan Water to supply the Foxconn plant in southeastern Wisconsin. You can read more about that and follow his coverage at wiscontext.org. More children are living away from their homes in Wisconsin, being placed in foster care or with relatives, according to numbers from the state. 7,900 Wisconsin children lived out of home in February, up from 7,500 in 2016, and county officials say parental drug abuse is part of the story behind that increase. WPR reporter Danielle Kading is following the story. She joins us from our bureau in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How you doing?
Good. We'll talk about the long-term trends here in the number of kids in foster care.
Well, over the years, really the last 5 years, the number of kids that are being placed outside the home, it's been growing every year. It's grown 16% since 2012. At that time, there were about 6,200 kids in foster care or staying with relatives or other places statewide. Now it's up to about 7,500 kids. And just in February this year, that number had grown to 7,900 kids who were living outside the home statewide. So it's a continuing problem.
And looking at the causes, you heard from some people at the county level and elsewhere who are saying part of the story here is drug addiction. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the report from the state on out-of-home care, they cite a number of reasons from child welfare workers as to why they're seeing kids removed from the home. And the number one reason is neglect, and the second reason is caretaker drug abuse. And that's what they're seeing all across the state, really. In Ashland County in northern Wisconsin, the Health and Human Services Director there, Terry Barningham, said they're seeing more kids removed from the home due to meth abuse there and safety concerns. She says the amount of children that they put in placement has almost doubled from a year ago. And the cost to the county is also just about doubling, you know, where they were spending around $400,000 in 2016. They spent around $721,000 last year just to pay for kids being placed outside the home. So it's a growing problem for counties, and the caseloads that they're seeing with the number of families or kids that are coming through their office, it's really hard for them to keep up with that. And so basically they're just kind of treading water, and they're spending less time with families and being able to reunite them, you know, do the work to reunite them. So it's just becoming more and more difficult.
Is this putting a strain on human services budgets in counties and at the state level?
I think without a doubt. I mean, if you look at $405,000 to $720,000, I mean, when you look at counties, it's a lot of them don't have a lot of extra money lying around. I know in Ashland County, they use excess money from timber revenues to try and balance their budget. But there's going to come a time when they just aren't able to do that, or there won't be enough trees or that they can use to supplement that. So what do you do?
And that gets more complicated because I imagine, you know, it's not a quick, there's not quick and easy solutions for a parent who's dealing with addiction. This is a long-term cure.
Yeah, no, I mean, the average amount of time that they're seeing parents who are struggling with drug abuse, it takes about 9 months to a year for them to be successful in treatment, if they are successful. And that's one of the big barriers with meth abuse in the northern part of the state is that, well, for one, it takes so long to reestablish yourself after drug addiction. But then just to find the resources to be able to do that is also very difficult. There's North Lakes Community Clinics in Ashland, and they have, I believe it's called the HOPE program there, that they work with. But there's no real inpatient treatment that's accessible for a lot of these people, and many of them need that to be able to get back on their feet.
Yeah, I wanted to ask more about access to addiction treatment services for parents. I've heard, I don't know if this is still true, but at one point pretty recently, the northernmost methadone clinic for people dealing with opioid addiction in the state was in Wausau. And there's, you know, Ashland County's pretty far north of Wausau. Is there access to addiction treatment for various sorts of addictions, apart from that Hope Center you mentioned?
You know, from what I know, it looks like there's a lot of services that may be available for outpatient services for things like counseling and therapy. But trying to find a place to stay, to separate yourself from your friends who are using or family members who are using, that's a lot more difficult to find inpatient treatment. And so that doesn't surprise me at all, Rob, to hear that the closest place would be in Wausau. That it's a constant problem up north is finding access to treatment.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter in Superior, about rising numbers of kids in the state in foster care or being placed with relatives in some cases. That increase being driven in part by an increase in drug abuse, leading to kids being removed from homes. And Danny, can you talk about the kids themselves? Are human services people finding it difficult to place these children in foster homes or with relatives?
You know, I know in La Crosse County that they have had some difficulty trying to find people who are able to take on kids. I mean, I think they said they had about 120 foster homes in the county, and they always need more. So I think trying to license people to be able to take care of children is an issue. You know, I can't speak to access in the northern part of the state. It seems like there is often a backlog where it's hard to find a place for kids to go.
And as you talked to people who worked on these issues in Ashland County and elsewhere, what were they saying the biggest needs were? What kind of help do they need in the short run, I guess, as these numbers go up?
Well, I think a lot of them would like to be able to do prevention so that they could stop this problem before it even starts, right? We'll work with families and keep them from using in the first place. They're not able to do a lot of that prevention right now because they're pulling those people to deal with their growing caseload. So that's an issue. Funding is an issue. The state has... I think it was $5 million. There was a $5 million annual increase in state aid allocations to counties that was included in this current two-year budget. And that's supposed to help counties with their growing caseloads and out-of-home care placement. But, you know, the counties are still footing a portion of that bill. So when you think about 72 counties and a $5 million annual increase, and we're already seeing like $400,000 in just one county for placement, there's just not enough money.
Has there been anything else coming from the state level? I know there was a foster care package that I may be mistaken included that money you were just talking about. Are there provisions there that might help, or that didn't make it through that might have helped?
Well, the state Senate passed 11 of 13 bills in that package, and those bills would have done a number of things. Some were aimed at prevention and providing more funding for a network that provides information for parents about health services. I can't speak to all the different bills that were proposed. I know that one that didn't pass would have had a committee of lawmakers that would have studied the caseload for child welfare workers. That didn't go through. But the state is working with county human services officials to look at that issue, to compare it to other states, to what an appropriate caseload would be and what would be the appropriate number of staff to deal with those cases.
And as you talked, again, to people who worked on these issues in northern Wisconsin and elsewhere, was there a concern that, not only that the numbers have gone up, that the trend is going up, that these problems are going to keep getting worse as time goes on?
I think there was, I would say there is a lot of agreement that as long as drugs continue to be an issue, whether it's meth abuse or opioid abuse across the state, that you're going to continue to see these problems where children or a growing number of children are removed from the home. Until you can address those underlying issues of why people are using or abusing drugs, then you're going to see more and more parents turn to that and more kids that are going to be removed from the home for safety concerns.
And you mentioned La Crosse County always looking for more foster parents. I'm guessing most counties around the state would feel the same way if people were interested in getting into foster care. They might not turn them down right about now.
I'm pretty sure they wouldn't turn anyone away who was, had a good enough heart and was willing to take care of children well. Especially children who are experiencing a lot of behavioral or mental health issues because of the atmosphere that they've been raised in.
We'll leave it there for now. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Danielle Kading. She's a reporter for WPR News. She's based in Superior. She joined us to talk about an increase in the number of children being placed in foster care or being placed with relatives in some cases around Wisconsin and the factors behind the rise that includes the growing problem with various forms of drug addiction, including, as we heard there, meth and opioid abuse in various parts of the state. You can read more of her reporting at WPR.org/news.
Wondered whatever became of me. I'm living on the air in Cincinnati, Cincinnati WKRN.
That's the opening theme song to the classic sitcom WKRP in Cincinnati. A lot of us radio types have a special place in our hearts for the show, based at a radio station. And when I was online the other day, I stumbled across the answer to a long-running mystery about the show. That opening theme tells us a clear story about a nomadic radio worker moving town to town, up and down the dial. But what's going on in the rockin' song in the closing credits for the show? Well, it turns out fans of WKRP have spent years trying to figure out those lyrics and transcribe them. They come up with lines like Red Tooth Bartender, Box of Night and a Hedda, Still Do the Morning and a Whack-A-Mo did uh-huh. Well, the other day I ran across the rest of the story. It turns out the lyrics sound like gibberish because they were gibberish. The creator of the song recorded a draft version with placeholder nonsense lyrics, figuring, yeah, they'll plug in the real words later. Producers liked the sound of the gibberish, so they decided the words didn't matter since announcers often talked over those end credits. And it was kind of a joke about hard-to-understand lyrics in rock music. Oh, meow.